those who may be listening to the webcast, you might be a little lost with this evening's lecture, because we have a bunch of charts that I had to photocopy a lot of them because I don't have them in electronic form. If you're local, like Sean and others who listen to the podcast or whatever you call it, you can see Carol at the church and pick up these items so that you can make sense out of what we're doing here. Now, this evening, we want to come back to Romans 12, 1 and 2, which is kind of the crescendo. It's a verse that everyone uses in one way or the other for this question of God's will, which says to be transformed by the renewing of your mind so that you can demonstrate what is the Lord's will. Now, that's not to find it again, but it's asking for the process of mental renewal and growth as a Christian, and that growth is always tied to the text. We've looked at a lot of verses. There's a lot more that you've read on your own that relate to this question, and we've seen over and over and over again that when we talk about what God desires, which is the same as saying what God will, what is God's will, we've seen that there's two major patterns. There's a pattern of God's sovereignty, his control of creation, his control of the world. There were numerous texts in that regard, like Job 42 that I had mentioned, that I know that thou canst do all things and that no purpose of thine can be restrained. That's a faith commitment on our part. We don't always know how that works out. But God does orchestrate history in ways that we seldom know, maybe sometimes after the fact. We can look at the book of Daniel, for example, and look at the earth history and see some of that happening. Now, in terms of the notes on the first page of this fourth lesson, notice, what is a transformed mind? Well, a transformed mind is, here's your definition, is a process of thinking about life's issues in biblical terms. Be transformed by the renewing of your mind. This is Romans, like all of Paul's epistles, start with theological precepts that are worked out and moves into ethical precepts. And chapter 12 is actually beginning the last section, the ethical precepts section, very much focused on this issue of God's moral will. Since not all of life's issues have a proof text, in other words, when we have a question about what God desires, we often run to the Bible to see if we can find an answer to that. And here's the problem. You can find words in the Bible to address about anything and everything. The only thing that keeps you away from it is your own creativity or lack thereof. But the issue is what did that text intend to teach? What the words mean to you are irrelevant. What the text intended to teach is foundational. We have to move out from that. And that's not an easy thing to do. Surface reading of the Bible, moral truths come through in a glaring manner. Very little to be misunderstood there. We have a general concept of God's moral will, the implications of the Ten Commandments, and so forth and so on. So that all comes through quite well. But there are so many other issues in life. In the first chart, we'll see these in a moment, that there are no proof texts for. And then we're into a whole new territory of trying to make a decision about what God would desire if he could tell us directly. So we need to develop a biblical worldview and value system to apply to the issues we need to discern. Basically, all that means, fancy language for try to figure out what the Bible is saying and relate it to your current context. That sounds simple, and it's not. But at the same time, that is really what we're about. Christian conversion, the second paragraph, brings a new set of beliefs to the table. And as we've said over and over, Romans 12, 1 and 2 calls for a conscious reorganization of how we think about ourselves and about our world. It gives us a new perspective. That's what worldview is about. When you become a Christian, you start changing your worldview. Now, something as simple as we mentioned before, that one preacher who said that before he was a Christian, he loved things and used people. But after he became a Christian, he is supposed to love people and use things. The very opposite. In other words, instead of manipulating all of life to serve our own little narcissistic needs, we should be looking at a bigger picture, community rather than individual, for example. American life is based very much on individualism. The Bible is very based very much on a community system. And so are other parts of our globe, but not the U.S. so much. The United States, Kennedy, I think, coined the phrase rugged individualism. And that's very much who we are. We sort of breathe that in our American values. But that's not really the biblical values. We are supposed to become self-conscious in a process of self-evaluation in the way we think about ourselves and our world. And I'm going to try to show you, these aren't simple charts sometimes, but they're practical because they make you go through steps and think about how you're going to do this. So let's start this. What is a world view? Without going into lots of detail, a worldview is a lens. The chart number one that we just distributed a moment ago, what you've seen before in different ways. We have our stick person drawn. We have decisions that need to be made on the left. The arrows go through the mind, which is drawn like a heart, because as a person thinks in their heart, so are they. And then the answers come out on the other side. This is true about everybody and anybody. This basic chart could be used in an atheist conference, because they have a worldview. It could be used in a Muslim conference. They have a worldview. It could be used with Baptists or Methodists or Presbyterians who have different views of things, but still, everybody has a worldview. And the answers that we give are answers that are somewhere along the line processed. Maybe we inherit the answers. All of us as Christians have done that more or less through our lives. We go to a church, we hear what we're supposed to believe, and we believe it. If we're thinking people, we think through it. We may challenge it. It may not be an issue of orthodoxy, and we'll talk about this in a moment, but at a different level. So a world is just a lens. It's putting on your Christian glasses, your biblical glasses, and reading the world through that lens. We define and describe our world and the experiences we have. It's a mental framework that evaluates the issues, the data with which we are confronted, and we provide an answer. We mentioned a long time ago that worldview basically is made up of three things. Who are we? How and what do we know? And what do we do? Those are the basic descriptions of these fancy terms of ontology, epistemology, and axiology. I taught introduction to philosophy in college. I was a warm body, so they gave me a textbook and threw me in the classroom. Nobody else wanted it, and this was a small school, obviously. But it was probably one of the best things that ever happened to me, because I had to grapple with what is the structure of life. Philosophy brings out the structure of life. It's not anti-Christian. Christians use some of the same categories and answer it through biblical terms. Now look at the chart, number one. Please write number one on the one that was distributed to you with the statements. On the left, here are kind of decisions that more or less everybody's faced, and this list could go on and on and on. For example, a decision of birth control. Birth control is different than abortion or morning after pill or things like that. Some people can use those things in that regard. But the question of birth control, you say, well, we never really thought that much about it. Maybe you practiced it early in your marriage until you got established, and then you decided you wanted to have children and so forth and so on. In Russia, and Rex and Lori can probably state this better, but in Russia, they were dead set against allowing birth control in the sense of what American Christians took for granted in terms of taking a pill and not to get pregnant for a while. But birth control, you see, now you can have two different sets of Christians answering the birth control question differently, because while they're both Christians, they have a different worldview about what they're going to say, not necessarily because the Bible told them anything about it. The Bible doesn't really have a passage on thou shalt not use birth control or thou shalt use birth control. That's a pretty big decision to young couples. And so it's not the direct teaching of Scripture, and perhaps not even the implied teaching. So you have to reason why you would or you wouldn't from other biblical values and find peace, get peace as a product of your reasoning. Peace is never the reason to do anything, but peace is a product of that reasoning. Abortion. I hate to say this too. There's really not direct teaching texts in Scripture about abortion. In the ancient world, abortion was done by exposure. That's what they did to Moses when they put him in the basket in the bulrushes. They controlled populations by exposure. Either the girls or the boys, usually the girls, would be taken and left to die in the desert or somewhere else. That was their population control procedures on many occasions. So believers have faced different challenges in relation to what a believer do in relation to that kind of a question. Abortion in our society, obviously, has gone crazy. It's on steroids, there seems like, for me at least, for Christians, to be very little choice about that question. But nonetheless, people will debate it, and it's the worldview that's going to determine the answer to that. I have an illustration in my book, which I purposely put there to be aggravating. And the illustration is I've got an unbelieving woman who is basically an atheist, and I have a believing woman. And they're both making the decisions about children and what to do. And they both come to the same conclusion: no abortion, keep your children. But they get there for different reasons, because their worldview dictates different things. And so it's that center that determines the outcome and the answers. Living wills. I don't know, I never listened to the radio much, but who was the psychologist that was so heavy on the radio? James Dobson. People had mentioned to me before that James Dobson made a big deal out of don't give your children all your inheritance. That it's not good for them, because it can, especially if you're a person with a lot of money, it can destroy them, because then they don't work for themselves. And there's some good principles in all that. But because he said it, it became gospel with a lot of people. And it was a little bit of a debate created in that regard. So that's more of the issue of a will, not living will, which is usually medical. But that's another question. What are you going to do with your assets in relation to looking at death? And how many times will you have to change it if your children come and go in terms of favor and their own lifestyles? And how would you control it so they can't, if they're a challenged child, that they made so that they can't just lose it? How do you take care of those things? Those are huge decisions. And there are no proof texts in the Bible about that. You have to think about what you think is a biblical way of managing your assets and your money. What would be the best thing to do? And you won't find proof text, but that's part of your worldview. It's also part of your value system. These two things kind of merge together because they rest in the same place. And we'll make a little bit of a distinction about that in a moment. Finances, should you borrow? How much in debt should you be? Well, there's no proof text for that. But all of you who are here, who are young and with children, you've got to make decisions about that. How far do you stretch yourself? Do you buy a used car or a new car? Of course, they make it cheaper to buy a new one these days, almost. You know, they give you such easy loans to deal with things. But you have to, particularly early in life, you've got to make a lot of decisions about how far do you stretch yourself. Well, what is a biblical decision about that? There's no proof text for it. And so it's going to be very much with internal to your own family how you're going to deal with that. And it's important that Christians let each of their own family units deal with it and not try to tell them what they should do with it. That's something that each Christian is to care for. We are a community, but we are not to be in everybody else's business. That's not just an American value, I don't think. Educating children, public school, homeschool, private school. How are you going to educate your children? That's a huge one, isn't it? There's no proof text. And you can't go back and say how the Hebrews did it and I'll do it the same way. Sorry, that's not going to work. That's a descriptive thing, not a prescriptive thing. And if you want to get into arguments, you will get into them real quick, young couples will, on that score. The issues of homeschool and non-homeschool. Earth stewardship. Are you responsible for this earth as Christian? Now, this is an interesting one. Should we be concerned about phosphates, and should we be concerned about whatever the globe does and what other nations do to the globe and all this plastic in the ocean and so forth? And we could even bring something like poverty into this, immigration, and on it goes. Somebody tell me, is that an option for us to just leave on the table, or do we have some responsibility, and if we do, why? Any idea of where the Bible teaches us about this issue?
Genesis.
It said to do what? Have dominion on the earth, yes. It's called the creation mandate. There are two mandates in Scripture, the creation mandate in Genesis and the evangelism or discipleship, actually, mandate in the book at the end of the Gospel. So those are the two mandates. And particularly Baptists, some groups of Baptists, have been guilty in the past of ignoring the creation mandate. Because evangelism is the only thing that counts. Yeah, I mean, you could ask yourself as a church, what projects does this church have in its community that's not related to this church group? Are you doing anything for the underprivileged? Are you doing anything for rescue missions? What are you going to do when someone comes up wanting food on the street? You going to give them $5 and... Are you going to take them to the restaurant and buy it for them? Or are you going to maybe come up with a system where you hand them a card? And that card will get them a meal and a night, a hot and a tot or whatever. Those are things churches face every day. And the more prominence you have, especially when you have a building that someone can come into, all kinds of interesting things happen. I've got a lot of stories there. And some of my friends who have a lot of stories, other pastors. About this question of how do we deal with the indigent? And it's getting to be a big issue. And it ought to, I mean, people are living in their cars. It's not just the people under the bridges anymore. And we all have seen what's happening in California, even 10,000 times probably worse than even New York in terms of the homeless. And a lot of issues there. Should a church be concerned about that? Or do you just, take care of yourselves? Earth stewardship is an interesting question. There are going to be different views on that. I was in a pretty large church in Indianapolis back a number of good many years, decades now, and there was a lawyer in that church who was very socially minded, and he was always wanting everybody to march. And he would announce that there would be a march at such and such a place on such and such a day. And he was trying to pull me in to get on board in that regard. And it was about a 1,500 member church, and I was an interim pastor there. So one Sunday, I just preached on it. And basically what I said is, we all have to make our decisions about what we're going to do about this, and mind your own business about what somebody else decides. And we got along great. He even invited me over for dinner every now and then. And but I'm not going to march, but I wasn't going to not support him, because what he was doing was a good cause. It was just not something that I felt like called for me to get out and march about, even though the issue was enough to do that. Maybe it's just my own foibles about some things like that. But we all as Christians are dealing with that. And that's part of decision making. That's part of asking the question, what is God's will? But the problem is this, is that sometimes when we ask what is God's will, we're getting an umbrella rather than just one specific answer to that. Under this umbrella of God's will, there's John over here, who's the lawyer who's marching, and there's Gary over here, who could preach on social issues and yet not do it the same way John did it. As Christians, we deal with those kinds of yings and yangs, and we have to give each other space for our personal convictions on that. And I'll illustrate this in a moment with the issue of values. So, I mean, we don't think a lot about earth stewardship. We don't think about a lot about community stewardship for a number of different reasons. Most of us, particularly in your younger years, you're just working like a dog to survive and try to have some stable life. And then when you get old, you're thinking about going to work, back to work, so you can have a stable life, right, Pepper? And so we're all, at, no matter where we are on the continuum, it doesn't make any difference. We're still dealing with that issue of dealing with life. Well, we both need to see our hairdresser. All right, social drinking. I don't think that's much of an issue here, but I'd like to tell you, 20 years ago, if you even asked the question, you'd get thrown out of church, particularly a Baptist church. And I think everybody still has opinions about it and strong feelings. If we were going to get into the next chart, we'd see how we would deal with that. But that's going to be answered by our worldview, how we're going to answer it. I was interviewed for a job one time at Winston-Salem, and the doctor my wife was going to work for took us out to the country club for dinner. And the school I was going to go teach at was a teetotaling type school. And so we sat down for dinner. First time I ever had escargot. I really didn't know what it was. I ate it, and it wasn't too bad, but the garlic was what was really good. But he said, would you like a glass of wine? I said, no, we don't drink. And so he poured it half full. At the table. And I was just sitting there waiting for some board member to come by. And here's a new professor at the school who has already drunk half a glass of wine at this evening thing. But I just told him, I said, listen, the Bible has absolutely nothing to say about being a teetotaler. It talks about moderation, and it talks about wine in good ways, for example. There's no teetotaling idea that is often presented by people, but it's a choice. In America, and then I could say something like, in American culture, it's a good choice not to, because there are so many who struggle with it. But the fact is that it's just not on the radar like it used to be. Elderly care. You know, have you thought about this as a church? What's God's will for you as a church and the elderly? Gloria started a group in the Presbyterian Church of widows. Doesn't take long. And as your church grows, you're going to have them. Seniors are the big population. What are you going to do, Rex, when a senior couple comes and they want to get married, but if they get married, they'll lose 50% of their income because of the adjustment on Social Security? You can answer me later. But that will be a question. People will come into your office with those kinds of things. Well, no, because that's not biblical. That's Old Testament. I wish you would tithe, because then I'd get some money from you, because I'm a Levite. Okay. All right. So, but there's a lot of issues. I mean, when do you put your loved one in care? How long does it go? What do you do when they have no resources? I mean, we all face this in my life. Our family has faced it with my mother, a glorious family. They die with their boots on. Mama's 98 and still cooking. But I'll probably be a Looney Tune within a decade, and Gloria will have to deal with me. I know what she'll do. She'll just set me out by the pool and rinse me off every now and then. But these issues come home to roost, particularly in situations where the resources are slim. You just don't have many choices, and it's tough. It's broken up families. Lawsuits. What are we going to do about that? Well, I wish, go hear my material on 1 Corinthians 5. The Bible, 1 Corinthians 5 is not a text to be used against lawsuits. That's complete misuse of that text. Because it's relating to Roman law in the first century, which is a completely different thing than America. That's another issue. Church polity. You never discuss that, but that is an issue that a lot of churches face. Elder rule, congregational rule, combination of the two. There's just all kinds of things. In fact, the view books over in our library even have that all delineated out. Every one of those questions, and probably a longer list that you would have individually, we all do the same thing with the list. We take it through the grid, the worldview grid. So now we're going to have to define a few things, and we'll come to the question of, well, what happens inside that grid? That's where we're going. That's where we're heading. Let's talk a minute about values. Worldview is a lens, a perceptual set that we make decisions from. Hand this out, but just set it aside, folks. That looks almost like the same one you had. It just takes the W out. The one we just talked about is worldview, the WV. The one you're getting now is just a V, that is values. Worldview and values, we don't want to try to do a lot of delineating, because values are a product of worldview. And yet values aren't exactly always the same, because they are a product. But we run a lot of questions, and the issues of questions, through our values system. Now, what's a value? A worldview is a lens. It's a total rational lens. But a value are what we'll call basic personal beliefs. Now, let me ask you, as a Bible person, what would be the most foundational value of all? What would be the most foundational value of all? You want to take a guess at that? Just turn them upside down in order. There you go.
Believe in Jesus Christ.
Do what?
Believe in God.
There you go. Anybody got a proof text? Belief in God. Exodus 3:14 is the most basic belief in the Bible. I am. Who sent me? I am that I am. That's an ontological statement, the personhood of God. But that's the most basic belief. What would be another basic belief that Christians would have? Just in general. Don't be afraid to spit it out. What would be another basic belief? Okay, that's true. Let me not be so theological. Okay? What would be another basic belief? Oh, everything's theological to some extent. Honesty? It's a basic belief, isn't it? What's some others along those lines? Oh, you're... I just surprised you, and you're sitting there spinning. What's some other basic beliefs? Sanctity of life. That's a big one, isn't it? You don't have a proof text, but the Bible's pretty clear on that.
Work ethic.
Work ethic, absolutely. Work is a... work. In the garden before sin, they had to work. That's an interesting one. But you know what another one is? The play ethic. Work is huge, and we tend to focus on that a great deal, particularly in Reformed traditions. But there's also a play. In other words, life is work, but there's also moments of relaxation and enjoyment and so forth. So it goes in all kinds of different directions about our basic personal beliefs. Now, notice the range, the values range on a continuum. It goes from non-negotiable moral beliefs. Those would be values, such as don't steal, don't lie, those sorts of things. But the other end of the continuum is personal preference beliefs. So values, our basic personal beliefs about how do we order our life, runs on a huge continuum. From the moral will of God that's non-negotiable to our personal preferences that we have to deal with in community, in families, and all sorts of places. Chart number 3. There we go. To talk about values. And all of this, of course, is part of the context of ultimately making decisions. This chart is nothing special about it. It's just a chart, but sometimes it helps to picture things. In fact, the ones that have that fancy stuff is part of a slideshow that some of my students did one time, and I kind of like some of these charts. Values have different levels. For example, clear moral commands would be a non-negotiable side of values. Think about this for a moment. Is it okay for a believer to be a combatant, to be in the military, to be a SEAL who will kill people? And lots of them sometimes. Or to be a computer jockey in Langley who's in charge of a drone that's going to take out a whole village of the enemy in Afghanistan. So we're going to see from another chart in a moment that when we come to those kinds of decisions, thou shalt not kill. Well, what does that mean? Well, you could say, well, the Old Testament means thou shalt not murder. Well, what is murder? the person who's dying is not going to want to quibble too much about some of these terms. So we have to be very careful about the quibbling side of life in that regard. The clear moral command, thou shalt not kill. Yeah, it's clear, but what does it mean? It really isn't that simple. And Christians throughout the ages have handled that differently, even in the early centuries of Christianity. And the Roman army conscription, there are historical episodes of Christians who have refused to be combatants. And in our own culture, we have a provision for non-combatants. Sometimes they become hospital people in the military. I remember that one movie, I can't think of the name of it, but the guy that lowered all of those soldiers off of the cliff all night long. And you may remember that. I can't remember the name of it. And saved, I don't know how many, scores of wounded soldiers. And before that time, because he was a non-combatant, they had all made fun of him. They had all sort of persecuted him for his beliefs. And he became a hero and won some of the highest medals that can be given for military valor. So there's all kinds of responses, even to things that seem to be a clear moral command, but we have to ferret that out, and that becomes part of a values system. There's actually, you can have a profession, your whole life with master's degrees and doctor's degrees just in this area. And a lot of people who get into government, maybe they were educated in these things. They just never take it to Washington. Okay? Just teasing, of course. Another area of personal of values is this issue of debated areas. We even have some of this in 1 Corinthians 8 to 10 and in Romans, where it talks about the question of Christians having a problem with meat offered to idols. Now, this is a passage that would require a little more time, and we'll talk a little more about this when we come to the question of conscience. After we get through this material, we're going to talk about some subjective issues, such as the work of the Spirit, the conscience, prayer, and some other things. But, for example, there were some who said, you can't eat meat that's been offered to an idol, because that's guilt by association. And then there were others who said, well, we're Christians who are beyond that juvenile belief that there are other gods. We only believe in one God, so we can eat anything we please. In Greco-Roman cities, they actually had restaurants in the temples. What were they going to do with sacrificial meat anyway? You know, there's always an entrepreneur somewhere. We have archaeology that shows, and guess what? Where are you going to have your wedding? You need a big building. You need food. You're going to party. Where are you going to do it? Well, many used the temple complexes. Now, if you go there, but you don't worship those gods, are you guilty by association in regard to syncretism with idolatry? Paul works through some of those issues in Corinthians and Romans, probably two different incidences. There's a lot of work on these texts. It's not always an easy question to ferret all that out. But those are very highly debated areas. Paul in Corinthians does, at the end of the day, says, I will not harm or violate my brothers and sisters. I would rather sacrifice than do that. But that's not the end of the discussion. For example, let me ask you this question. How long do you put up with a Christian who believes the wrong thing but is convicted about it and won't let go of it and wants everybody to conform to their view of it? Now, I don't know what I use in illustration. I live in the past so much. I mean, whether a woman could wear pants to church, you know, that's 50 years old. And nobody's going to get mad at me on this. Or whether they have to wear skirts all the time. I mean, the church in America, out in the country, went through these kinds of things. Or can you go to a commercial movie theater? I mean, all of you who grew up in southern churches, that was a big deal. In fact, a lot couldn't go to the beach together. They called it mixed bathing, which was a bad word, but that's what they used. I had some other illustrations until I said that one. Dancing. Okay, what about dancing? Tattoos.
To this day, some people won't go to restaurants
that serve alcohol. Yes.
Piercing.
Huh?
Piercing.
Oh, piercing. Piercing your body. Even just for earrings. There are Christians in Christian communities who divide over these things, which we could put into a debated category, because we don't have proof texts that are telling us exactly how to go. In fact, sometimes we have proof texts that say you shouldn't make an issue out of it, but somebody's going to make an issue out of it. That's the domain of values. Values are always driven by worldview, but that's the product of that worldview is in this domain of values. And Christian communities, when you're not in a domain that's clearly identified as a moral category, you have to make some decisions about that. And sometimes you agree to disagree. That's the best course of action. But not many people are mature enough to do that very well. I've seen in this church, in Sunday school on occasions, to agree and to disagree. That's good. But this can go on and on and on at many different levels. I haven't seen any buttons really pushed around here very much, but I'm sure that if we pushed long enough, we'd find some buttons that would get start to divide some opinions. But here comes the interesting one, and that's called personal preferences. Personal preferences. Now, some of the things we just mentioned could be put into the personal preference category, but other things, maybe not so much. What if somebody goes to church but doesn't go to Sunday school? Are the ones who don't go to Sunday school bad? Or maybe, we don't have but about a fourth, if at the most. That would be generous, a fourth of the ones who come on Sunday morning who are here on Wednesday. Well, should we be peppering people and being concerned about that as if they are failing? Or should we assume that they have enough integrity to make a good decision? Now, most churches have a hard time giving anybody else enough integrity to have good decisions if they disagree with you. That's human nature, isn't it? But that's in the domain of personal level of values. It's not a moral command, but it can create an awful lot of havoc in churches. I mean, most churches have problems in those areas more than they do about orthodoxy. They don't even know what it is, orthodoxy. Or theology or something else, but they have a lot of problems in the superficial structures about what should be done and how it should be done. And so this is a fascinating area. There's a writer I have mentioned to Josh before called Thomas Groom, who wrote a book on the practice in a church of our faith. And how you process, it's called shared. It's got a fancy word, too. I'll just give it to you. Praxis just means practice. I have a bunch of charts from that book and from a former colleague of mine that would take churches through these processes of about six or seven steps to move from the question to conviction. We're not talking moral conviction here. We're just talking conviction about how to do something. And it could be just any number of things. And what you're doing is you're moving. You've got leadership, and you've got congregation, and if leaders were to get into the pulpit and just kind of pound the pulpit on, this is what we're going to do, what's the first reaction they get? Well, you say, well, sinful nature is going to say, just wait a minute here. What do you mean you're telling me what we're going to do? And other reactions could be, well, I don't know if I agree with that. And I've seen this happen in a lot of churches where you've got demagoguery for leadership rather than trying to process things. This is all called collegiality. And you can pound the pulpit all day and not change people's minds. Because why? Because change of mind comes where? If leadership wants X to be done, do they pronounce and proclaim X, or do they teach and talk about and reason so that the X that's over here becomes the X that's here, which ends up being the X happening over here? It's a process. It's a very it's delicate. It's even complicated for those who apply the trade of leading a group of people to think without manipulation. Manipulation is the game of most religion. Churches manipulate people all the time in one way or the other, sometimes unconsciously, sometimes just because they're prima donnas. I've seen a lot of that sort of thing over my career. So values, you see, can run quite a gamut. It's because it's not a moral command that is direct teaching of Scripture that expects a response without question, but it is parsing out our view of life. But we're Christians. Being Christians means we bring the Bible to our view of life, but it doesn't mean that everybody comes to the same conclusion. And God hasn't created a process or a commentary that will achieve that. We have an inspired Bible, but there's never been an inspired commentary. Some of them are more inspiring than others, to use the word in a different way, but not there. Okay, chart number 4. Now, there's a whole lot more to say than what I'm saying, but this is the kind of thing you need to say several times and go over, and so that's what we'll do here from time to time. Page 2 of your main note package, developing an evaluative model to process questions. We've talked about the sovereign and the moral will of God. Is this still on off to the side or something? We've talked about, and here's the tricky piece, that there is no such thing as you having to find your own personal will from God in order to make a decision. All Christians are on level ground here. We process Scripture. We don't find me, myself, and I from God. We have the same pool in which to operate and to process. There's a funny story. There was a man named Herman Hoyt who was the president of Grace Seminary, where I was a student and I also taught for a number of years. He was an old German, and he could be the sweetest, nicest guy, and he could be like a bull in the china shop. My wife worked in offices at the school, and he'd be gone for a month, and while he was gone, things would kind of get awry. And he'd come back in, and he didn't mean to. He'd just slam the doors and go in with another administrator, slam the door, and the walls would move, you know. In fact, he walked through a glass door one day broke it all to pieces. But on the other hand, he wasn't being mean. He was just being German. It's like my friend who was another German fellow I taught with had on his briefcase. He said, "Germans are just sour krauts." But Dr. Hoyt was the president of Grace Seminary. And back in those days, when you went to a school, there wasn't any such thing as student rights. The only right was to come to campus and do your work. And a student went into his office one day, and I heard him tell the story. It was really funny. But the student went into his office, and he was complaining. He said, "President Hoyt, I don't have any electives. I can't choose the courses I want. You've given me 96 hours of graduate-level courses, and you've told me everything to take except for one course. That's not fair." And Dr. Hoyt looked at him and said, "Son, did you choose to come to Grace Theological Seminary?" He said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Then you chose every course that we have in the curriculum." End of discussion. I like that. You know, that's old school. Trust the wisdom that you've inherited in that sense. All right. So God's will at the end of the day is godly discernment. But boy, that takes some work. We're not talking about proof text discernment, not taking a concordance. And remind me, Dave, to ask Carol about finding some concordances. I don't think we've covered that yet. They're very handy. At the bottom of that chart, God's will is revealed in Scripture. We've seen that. We've seen that His moral will, His sovereign will are there. There are many values that are in Scripture that are a part of that moral will category. Godly discernment is built from that and then applied to life's questions. God's will is applied as you move up that chart. So at the end of the day, God's will is godly discernment. Simple and yet, challenging in terms of doing that process. Now, let me give you the master chart here to talk about that. Now, this coming week, we'll spend some time next week on this, on what we're doing now. But I really want you to think through these things so that we can have a lot of discussion. Write down issues that you grapple with, or you can present that someone else grapples with, and be indirect about it. However you want to do it, we won't accuse you of struggling with the issue. But we all have issues that we struggle with. We know others struggle with, and we're going to run them through these charts. We're going to think about how do we process and work on making a decision in these domains. How do we do that? Well, I got the idea of this chart a little bit, I guess, from electronics. It's a flow chart, and it starts at the top where a decision is presented to you. The first box is a box of decision, which is this question covered by a clear command? If the answer is yes, you obey the command. And that's the end of the chart. Now, of course, what's the key word in that question? Clear, yes. I need more sophistication in the chart. I just don't have room. Okay, you got to have a chart on one page, don't you? And so a clear command, that word clear is really crucial. If you're not sure that it's a clear command, you go to the left and you study for clarification. Part of that could be based on the principles of Romans and 1 Corinthians. And I really need another block in here on this. I'll get to it in another chart rather than this one in a moment, because it's easier to do there. And you come to a conclusion about your question. If you decide after some work that it is something that you should obey, well, you go right back up to obey the command, and that's the end of the discussion. Yes, it's an expectation to obey. But if you say, no, it isn't, you go to the bottom box. Process data through your biblical worldview and value set. That bottom box is just a snippet of what needs to go on in your brain when you're processing data. And it's more like a computer, your brain, in terms of how it would process things. But there's certain categories. For example, notice on the outside of it. Let's cover this verse. Whenever we're making decisions, we're praying. We're not trying to boss God, or we can't be too specific because we're trying to decide some things. So we're praying for discerning wisdom. Nothing wrong with that. I'm not using James as a proof text. That would be a misuse of James, just depending on what this question is. But the fact is we're just asking God, help me to be wise. You know what one of my main prayers is? Lord, help me not to screw this up. Help me. I pray this all the time. Lord, please protect me from myself. And another one that's in John. Lord, I believe. Anybody finish it? Help my unbelief. That one comes up all the time. And you have an attitude of submission to Scripture, to God's sovereignty and providence on that far right, back to the far left. You carry it out with an attitude of this, of what we've been talking about. And part of that whole chart, I thought I had stated it specifically here, but for some reason I don't see it, is this, the submission would cover it, submission to God and to His processing. Providence is a big piece of this. Now, first, identify the values that underlie the decision. Compare these to your value model pro-biblical teaching to critique your situation from all relevant areas. Now, that's a mouthful. I'm going to give you the next chart in a moment that will help that. But here's the bottom line. The first thing that you should do when you're working on a decision is to engage your critical self-awareness. If you're a parent and you don't want your teenage child to do something and you're going to make a decision that's affecting them, one of your first questions should be, why am I making this? Why do I feel so strongly about this? Am I critically aware of my own processing? Is it self-protection? Is it protect them, which I can't at the end of the day always do? I mean, that's pretty complicated, isn't it? Critical self-awareness may be the most difficult thing for any human being to achieve. We don't know ourselves. Every one of us presents a facade to the world. We have a facade that we present to ourselves. Breaking through those things requires a lot of discipline. The first time I broke that ceiling a little bit was when I got discharged from the Navy. I've been in 4 years. I was on a destroyer for three or more, over three, I guess. And every 6 months, the officers in charge of your area would do a evaluation of you. And I don't know why. I don't know, Bill, if you got this or not. But when I was discharged, one day I got this big package in the mail. It wasn't real big, but it was a nice big envelope, 8.5 by 11 type thing. And in that envelope was every evaluation that I had ever been subject to in my career in the Navy. There were four or five different officers who had done it and signed off on it. And I sat down and read those things. And that was the first time, I think, in life I ever experienced seeing myself through someone else's eyes and getting it. I still deal with some of the characteristics and come back to some of those characteristics that they saw in me. And it was very interesting because it wasn't just the authoritarianness of the military. It was these officers who were just out of college themselves, many of them, who were mature enough to be able to make an evaluation of my actions as a radioman and my leadership in radio and my work ethic and my religion was in there. And I was pretty bold when I was in the Navy. I was a new Christian and much more outward. Of course, I was in a context. I could tell you stories there, but that you'd enjoy them, but you don't want to hear all this. But the fact is that was one of the first times in my life where I ever felt critical self-awareness and knew I needed to listen to it. Most of us go through life and we don't listen. We don't listen to our parents. We don't listen to our teachers. We don't listen to others that have been there, done that, trying to help us. And it's not because we don't like them. It's because we don't have ears to hear. If I had just listened to half of the stuff that people that I respected told me through my life, I'd be a whole lot better off. But most of us just have to learn this stuff ourselves, don't we? And a big part of decision making as a Christian is critical self-awareness. Am I manipulating the Bible? Am I bending the Bible to my will? Am I trying to bend other people to my will? Why am I making this decision? Getting to that is no small task. Here's another one in my last one for today. Your human obligations. Do you realize that where you are in life affects how you respond to the Bible? Are you single? Are you married? Are you married with kids? Are you married? The kids are gone and the parents have come. All these stages of life the Bible speaks to in different ways. And we have to critically, again, be self-aware of our own human obligations and where we are. Paul makes it pretty clear that when you get married, you have made a choice that is so important, it's going to affect your Christian service. Do you realize that marriage trumps church? Sex in marriage trumps prayer in 1 Corinthians. You see, we've got our structures all skewed a little bit. Some of these things about the human family and marriage and so forth in Scripture are so core that we don't take adequate consideration of them in our decision-making process. And where you are on that continuum has something to do with the decision that you make, whether it's how much money you can spend, how far you can go in debt, not debt at all. Sometimes we have to wait our time to get to certain places. Maybe one illustration of that would be a young family. You know, you get married, and in this day and age, you want everything it took your parents 30 years to get. Two cars, new ones, nice apartment, this and that. And all of a sudden, you find yourself trying to adjust your income to the way you want to live rather than adjusting your living to your income. And you're in trouble. You're already underwater, because we didn't have the self-discipline to do it the other way around. Everybody faces that. And whether you're young, middle-aged, or seniors. As a senior, I feel that. You know, we've been accustomed to a certain lifestyle, but we're on fixed income. We don't have pensions. And we're actually into our principal on our required minimum distributions. We're really only getting about $1,500 a year new. Now everything else has already been put in there in one way or another. And and if you ignore that for too long, you can see what could happen. All of us, no matter where we are in life, beginning or end of our continuum, we have to deal with these kinds of things. And it's a biblical for us to do that. And yet the Bible even portrays certain responsibilities in relation to each of those kinds of categories. That you have to make decisions in relation to family, children, parents, and so forth. It has implications in relation to our Christian lives. Paul was very clear about that in relation to marriage. And there are other places even where it's clear in relation to family units. Well, I'm going to stop there. I'd like you to think through. And the next chart we're going to come to, let's go ahead and let me give you this one. This is number 6. It goes with number 5. I hope you've been putting numbers on these. Number 5 is what we were just talking about. Number 6 is coming to you. And number 6 processes you in a little larger way, but and takes into consideration number 5. And all of this is just methodology. These aren't final. There's much more to be said, much more to be included in categories. But these are basic categories that should be part of the way that we think about the decisions that we make. And you may say, geez, I don't want to think that hard. I'll just make the decision. Well, lots of times we do that, don't we? We just do it without thinking. And sometimes it works out, and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it gets us into stress, gets us into tension. Sometimes everything's okay. And there's a lot of menial decisions in life that don't take this kind of intensity. But the fact is that serious decisions require a serious consideration. And in life, we've got a lot of serious decisions that we make in our journey. Okay, now next time, we'll have plenty of time for discussion. So write things down. Don't assume that you'll remember it. Assumption is the first step for making a mistake. Get things written down and recorded, and we'll talk about it. We'll do this a couple of times, and then we'll be on to some interesting pieces that will come up about the subjective areas of life that influence us internally, such as spirit, conscience, and so forth. All right? You have a good week. Be careful out there. It's a mean world.